I was convicted on innuendos and things that I said.
And I'm the kind of person who I need to understand it. I need proof. I need the facts to make sense to me. And what doesn't make sense to me is why all these people who don't know each other would testify that you said these things. Why would these unrelated people from different parts of your life all testify that you made incriminating statements?
At Jeff Titus's trial, 15 of his former co-workers testified against him. Most of these witnesses had worked with Jeff at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Battle Creek, where Jeff had been employed from 1976 until 1994. And all of them said that while working with Jeff, he had made incriminating statements to them about his role in the Fulton Game Area murders.
Like, they're saying you said you probably did it, or you'd shoot people in the back.
I did talk about the gun. I found the gun. I turned around and told people about it. I mean, it was in the paper. They would ask me questions about it. I mean, a lot of times I didn't bring it up. It would be them bringing it up. Then I told them. Now, for me to say, well, did you shoot him? And I said, did I? Probably. Why would I say that? It doesn't make sense.
Jeff says he would have talked to many of these co-workers about the Fulton Game Area murders because it was a subject that came up in conversation a lot. But Jeff denies ever saying the specific comments that these witnesses testified about.
Is it possible then you could have said some of those statements in passing? If someone was on my property, I'd shoot them?
No, I don't think I would have said that. Mm-hmm. Only if someone, I had to defend myself.
Well, do you think you could have exaggerated, said something to impress people? You know, maybe after having a couple beers at the bar, you could have said something as a way.
Yeah, but see, it wouldn't have been at no bar because all them people were at work or whatever. The majority of them. And I don't go to a bar.
Jeff said that these 15 co-workers who testified against him are not telling the truth, that he didn't say the things that they say he told them.
So the people who came to testify about the things you were saying, what do you think their motivation was?
I do not know.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 9 of our series on the state versus Jeff Titus. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, A Non-Story. And I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Jeff joined the military after high school, and after 4 years, he got out of the Marines and came back to Michigan, where he enrolled in college and soon got a job working security at the Veteran Affairs Medical Center in Battle Creek. The VA hospital is a sprawling medical complex on the edge of town, and although it provides a variety of medical services to veterans in Michigan, it is primarily a neuropsychiatric facility.
You know, that's a psychiatric medical center. They might want to claim it's a medical center, but it's a nut house is what it is.
I've spoken to a lot of Jeff's old coworkers, and often after these interviews, the part that stood out the most to me was not what I'd learned about Jeff Titus or the murders, but what I'd learned about the VA itself.
No, the conditions of the VA sounds are pretty horrible.
It sounds horrible. I mean, the fact that they had people patrolling for patients who got out is crazy.
I thought it was going to say 3 or 4 times a year, and he's like, 3 or 4 times a week.
Yeah, like, they just couldn't keep it safe or secure.
We heard stories about a tree out in the VA yard they'd finally had to cut down after it became known as the hanging tree, and about a patient who'd starved to death in his hospital bed with somehow no one noticing, and about a skeleton found in the nearby woods that turned out to be a patient who'd wandered away and not been found. Conditions at the VA are, by all accounts, much better now than they were back then when Jeff Titus was working there in the 70s and 80s. But as Jeff's friend, Big Jack Warren, recalls, the VA could be a rough place to work. Though Big Jack later moved to working at the medical center's power plant, he'd started off as a plumber there.
In the morning, they would hand out work orders. You didn't go to Building 39. It was referred to as Knuckle City. You would wait until the officers had left the building and got people drugged up to where they weren't as combative. Then you could go in there and do your job.
One of the nurses who'd worked with Jeff Titus was Irene. She'd been stationed out in the ward in the building that Big Jack calls Knuckle City.
On where I was working was 39 East. It's only had 10 patients, and I mean, they were... And we had four people all the time. And then we had a radio, and then if somebody would, berserk, we could call them. They could, help us put him in a cuff and belt and lay him on their bed.
It wasn't just the requirements of the job that made the VA a challenging place to work. One of Jeff's old coworkers had described the place to me as the weird duck farm, and he had not been talking about any of the patients there. One of the first witnesses in this case I spoke to was Jack Warren, and he was the first person to tell me what life at the VA had been like.
The VA is paid in place number two. That's true.
You were kidding. You told us that when we met last time, and then I talked to everyone else, and like, yeah, you were right. Mm-hmm. It was drama. Mm-hmm.
This stuff goes on out there.
But if his lawyer had been halfway decent and they had done any investigation, they had found out.
And it's not like Jeff was the only one people had issues with. Because like, I'll start talking about Jeff and they'll be like, oh, this other guy? Oh man, he was even worse. That guy was awful. I'm like, no, let's talk about Jeff right now.
Peyton Place, in case you're wondering, like I was, is a soap opera that ran back in the 60s. It's full of convoluted drama and meandering love affairs. But if anything, the storylines from the VA were messier than anything on Peyton Place. While Jeff Titus and the murder case had been a favorite point of gossip for a while, it was by no means the biggest scandal to hit the hospital.
The drama at the VA had a lot of sources. There were, of course, the romantic rivalries among the staff.
Yeah, that's why I called the place Peyton Place. A lot of guys, or a lot of people, should say, are divorced or kind of frisky.
There was workplace intrigue as well. In some of the correspondence that was included in Titus's personnel file, one of the nurses complained that after she'd been switched to work in a new ward in a different shift, her friends that she'd worked with on the old ward had become paranoid about her because they were worried that she'd gone and, quote, turned them in for something, and that's why she was avoiding them. And at the VA, gossip was the currency of the realm.
And then you find other stuff that's, rumors, So you knew what was going on.
I've heard there were a lot of dramas going on.
All the time, You heard from anybody and everybody, and if you wanted to, you better not say nothing because it spreads right,
When Jeff Titus's co-workers found out that two men had been murdered not far from his farm, it's no surprise there was a lot of talk about that, too.
It was the talk of the hospital.
Okay, so the hospital was talking about it a lot.
Yeah, and so people were forming opinions on how he had acted around them,
So it wasn't just Jeff talking, it was others talking about
him. Oh, yeah.
But then later on, he came back and other people were talking about it. He said, yeah, he shot somebody and killed him.
So people at the VA were talking about it?
Yeah, too.
Like co-workers?
Yeah.
So that was like a, I guess it came up a lot, probably, or did
yeah,
it?
Yeah, for a couple of weeks.
One of the employees who'd worked with Jeff Titus, and who was still there 10 years later when the cold case team arrived and spent months out at the VA talking to Jeff's old co-workers, was Beverly. She had first learned of the accusations against Jeff from other security officers that she was friends with.
He goes, I can't believe you went on a ground search with him back in the woods. Because we had a ground search to go on to look for a patient.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
And I said, oh, get out of here, just joking. He goes, he's been accused of, he might have murdered somebody or something like that. When I thought about that after he was arrested, or after he was, taken to court and stuff, I thought, oh my God, maybe he did do that.
Now, Beverly had not been one of the witnesses who testified against Jeff at his trial. But a lot of her coworkers had. Jack Warren's wife, Diane, was able to sit through parts of the trial, and she saw a number of them take the witness stand.
So you heard the VA witnesses. Well, what do they call that? No. Did it?
I think they called everyone that didn't like Jeff to speak. To the point the judge said he had heard enough VA people.
It just kept going on. Like, it was, I think, half the trial,
It was constant.
It was constant, and it was kind of confusing. For the jury at Titus's trial, this testimony from all of these former co-workers would have seemed disjointed at times, with both witnesses and attorneys dancing around parts of the story that were being left unsaid. There were references to a prior investigation of some sort, as well as allusions to Titus's co-workers disliking him, but no straight answers as to what exactly the witnesses and attorneys were talking about. As one of the jurors told us, though, once the trial was over, they'd been allowed to hear the rest of the story.
And then the other was the guy that supervised him for while he was a security officer in the hospital up in Battle Creek, the Veterans Hospital. And after the trial was over, the judge, Judge Schaefer, came in and goes, "Remember that guy?" He said, we all go, "Yeah." And we said, there was something strange about it. It looked like he wanted to really start talking about what was going on, but he kept to the questions.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't. And what had happened was he fired Titus for sexual harassment.
In 1994, Jeff Titus was fired from the VA following an investigation into claims of sexual harassment. When Jacinda and I had first heard why Jeff Titus had been fired from his job at the VA, we'd had the exact same thought.
See, I guess in my mind, I'm thinking 1990, like it would have had to be pretty serious to get fired.
I mean, seriously, what would someone have to do to get fired for sexual harassment in the 1990s? You'd have to be like Harvey Weinstein or Louis C.K., right? And those guys didn't even get fired in the 90s. The cold case team may have been thinking along the same lines Jacinda and I were, because after learning what had happened at the VA, the cold case detectives had tracked down and interviewed as many women who worked with Titus as they could find. It was the statements they got in the course of that investigation that formed the bulk of the cold case team's case against Jeff Titus at the time of his arrest. From what I've seen in the files, I don't doubt that Jeff Titus should have been fired for sexual harassment. But I should be clear here. Calling this sexual harassment is my description of what happened. It's the term I'd use. But it's not the term that the women themselves used to describe their complaints. And it's not how the ones we spoke to would describe it now.
But she didn't describe it as sexual harassment. I mean, I think it was, but...
No, she didn't describe it as sexual harassment.
She'd only heard vague rumors of others possibly doing it. No wonder they didn't call her.
They didn't call her because she...
Yeah, like...
She didn't report it. She said it stopped.
The investigation into Titus had begun in 1994, after a nurse filed a complaint about him with the VA's Equal Employment Opportunity Counselor. The EEO counselor then interviewed her, as well as a few of the other nurses, and she concluded that a lot of the complaints against Jeff Titus followed a similar pattern. A nurse would become friendly with Jeff, and they would start to chat a lot at work. While doing his round to the medical center, Jeff would often stop by the nurse's ward to talk to them. At first, it was fine. The nurses wouldn't mind having someone to talk to and pass the time at work. But then Jeff would just keep coming back. Keep talking to them, keep being around them, and they become more and more uncomfortable with the situation. But they also felt like they didn't have the authority to tell him to go away. After all, he was a security officer. His job was to be there in the hospital. But his behavior made them very uncomfortable, and they did not know what to do. As one nurse, a woman named Amy, told the VA investigators, "You know, just when it goes on and on and on, and you're sitting there trying to do your work and, you know, trying to hint, like, leave, please, but he wouldn't go away." Michelle, another nurse at the VA, described Jeff's behavior in much the same way. The EEO counselor told investigators that her allegations against Titus were, quote, "a type of harassment other than really sexual, but the comments and behavior was such as to make her uncomfortable being around him. You know, more fearful of just being annoyed." Both Amy and Michelle, it should be noted, later testified against Jeff Titus at his trial. But not all of Jeff's coworkers experienced Jeff's behavior as a problem. Some nurses, like Irene, did not remember him causing any issues at all.
I don't know. I usually never had any problems with it, you know. And he was very friendly and stuff.
I've heard he may have flirted with some of the nurses.
Oh, all the nurses he flirted with. Even me, and I was old, you know. I was like, damn, you know.
So his reputation was just that, but otherwise he was okay.
Yeah. But he liked to come around. Well, if you're a security guard there, what are you going to do? You check the wards, and then there's nothing else to do. So he used to go through the different wards and sit down and chit-chat, you know. And then, especially on 392 East, where I was working, when the patients, they seen the security guard, you know, they were behaving themselves.
So I guess the nurses kind of liked having a security guard nearby.
Yeah.
Of course, even the coworkers who didn't mind talking to Jeff Titus often noted that they preferred not to talk to him for too long, as Jeff's conversational repertoire could be somewhat limited in scope.
Yeah, but anyway, he always talked about hunting or deer and shooting or something, you know, like he was a big hunter. It's just him and hunting. Didn't he have a kid too?
He had two little girls, yeah.
Yeah, he was talking once in a while about them.
Not all of the complaints about Jeff Titus were complaints about sexual harassment. Some of Jeff's behaviors annoyed both of his male and female coworkers alike. It wasn't the sort of behavior that creates a hostile work environment that amounts to sex-based discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. But where Jeff's behavior crossed the line into sexual harassment was when he repeatedly sought out certain nurses and talked to them at length because they were women.
But even if the women involved would not describe Jeff's behavior as sexual harassment, they did describe it as harassment, full stop. He would also get too personal in his discussions with the nurses that he worked with. He would tell them about how beautiful his wife was, or tell them about a fight the two of them had had. And he'd cross serious boundaries in ways that the women saw to be potentially threatening. He'd comment on the kind of car they drove, or chime in on conversations with information he'd found out about them while writing up parking tickets.
What do you recall about her?
Oh, she was... Because we turned around, we're talking, and then the ones I said, well, I know where you live. Because we sat there and was talking and stuff, and then she got real defensive and stuff. Like I say, because I was always talking to the nurse that worked in there. And then I know she made a complaint against me and stuff.
And Jeff Titus's friendships with the women he worked with caused other problems for him, too. Even when the women themselves had no complaints. One of Jeff's co-workers, Beverly, often talked to Jeff Titus at work and considered him a friend. It was Jeff's supervisor, not Beverly, that had objections to Titus speaking to her.
But when I wasn't working, I would go up there and we would meet and have coffee when he was on break. And my cousin told me to stay away from him. He said, you know, he's not trustworthy. And I said, well, he's never done anything to me.
Oh, he was his boss.
He was his boss, but he was also my cousin, too, so he was looking out for me. I guess him and Jeff didn't get along. And I guess he was telling him to stay away from me.
Paul might have thought there was a connection there.
Yeah.
Got it. So that would be what the conflict would be at the time.
Yeah, because he didn't want me getting involved with Jeff at all. And I couldn't understand why. Well, we weren't doing anything. We were just talking and, you know, having coffee and stuff like that.
And Jeff's friends at work, like Jack Warren, had seen that Jeff's actions were a problem.
Yeah, he thought he was a little bit of a Romeo. And I would try to tell him, you know, that's your wife. That's the mother of your children. Why are you jeopardizing that for something that's going to be a weekend stand or whatever, you know? It don't make no sense to me. And I know a couple of them were people that were called on a stand.
So did he actually have relationships with any of those women?
I know in a casual way he did, like helping them with doing landscaping, for example. He would help anybody, really, if they ask him, especially a girl.
Now, the sexual harassment allegations against Jeff Titus were not the kind of clear-cut misconduct that would guarantee he'd be fired from the VA. Because, yeah, in the 1990s, it did take a lot to get fired for sexual harassment. On the one hand, Jeff Titus's behavior was disturbing and persistent, and created an uncomfortable and even frightening workplace environment for the women he worked with. On the other hand, though, there's no record that he'd ever continued to harass any coworkers once he'd been instructed not to. As one report in the file notes, quote, "I spoke to the nurse and learned that Officer Titus was, indeed, frequenting the ward for varying periods of time. I asked her to make it clear to him that he was not to hang around the ward anymore. She did so, and the problem ceased immediately." There were also a number of nurses who'd written letters to Jeff's supervisors in his defense. They'd describe how Jeff Titus would stop by their wards a lot to chat, and he, quote, "sometimes talks too much about his family, but is never out of line. Once you told Jeff that you had to get back to work," they said, "he'd turn around and leave." Irene, the nurse from Building 39, described Jeff Titus in similar terms.
So she complained that he'd come up to her ward and talk to her all the time. She didn't like it.
Well, why didn't she just say, "Hey, get out of here," or something? I mean, you know, he used to come on, it was 39-2 East, okay, is lockdown unit. And we had 10 patients, and that's it. And shoot, sometimes, I mean, I was glad he was around for maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes, you know, so the patient would see him, and then it would give me an easier way. I wouldn't have to worry about some of them coming in.
If there had only been the sexual harassment complaints, Jeff Titus might not have been fired from the VA. There was enough ambiguity there that it might not have been enough for the VA to uphold his termination. But the case for Jeff Titus's dismissal became ironclad after he went in to testify before the VA's investigators.
No, they said I got myself fired because of the comment I made. That I could hit something from 200 yards or whatever.
Yeah, that probably didn't help.
Well, something like that, because like I say, I could shoot at 800 yards at a walking target silhouette of a man. I mean, I know it ticked somebody off because they said that was the grounds that they used to terminate me. He said it was intimidating.
At Titus's disciplinary hearing, the VA's regional director had been acting in the role of prosecutor, and he was the one who had questioned Jeff Titus and gotten him to talk about his shooting ability. As the regional director would later tell the cold case team, as soon as Jeff Titus had made the comments about his ability to shoot a human-sized target from several hundred yards away, he'd known he'd succeeded at his part of the job, and that Titus would be fired. The regional director had been right.
The reason that these old events from the VA hospital matter in this case, and the reason we have to talk about them now, is that when the cold case team reopened their investigation, they began by sending flyers that offered a $5,000 reward to Jeff's old workplaces. And after that, they talked to dozens of Jeff's old coworkers. For the first couple of months of their investigation, they were over at the VA almost every single day. And while the cold case team's interest in Jeff Titus as a suspect makes sense, it does seem unusual that they kicked off their two-year investigation into him by trying to learn everything they could about these old sexual harassment claims.
You can see why they looked at him.
I would look at him.
As a suspect. And then they dig up this stuff from the VA.
That's the part where I would be like, okay, well, let's go back to finding stuff that actually matters. But
is it a big jump from, like, harassing women to killing two random people?
The cold case team's strategy worked. These interviews about the sexual harassment investigation would turn up witnesses who later gave damning testimony against Jeff at his trial. Michelle was one of those witnesses, though she herself had not actually initiated any complaints against Jeff. Jeff had bothered her at one time, she said, but then he'd stopped. A couple of years later, Michelle's husband had heard that another woman had filed a complaint against Jeff, and he'd given Michelle's name as someone the VA investigators should talk to. That's how she ended up being interviewed about Jeff in 1994. When the cold case team talked to Michelle in 2000, she told them that Jeff had never mentioned to her that he'd ever been a suspect in a murder case. But she did tell the cold case team that he'd once threatened her husband. To the cold case team, this was new and potentially important information. The cold case team had heard lots of stories about Jeff Titus being weird. They had no shortage of statements about that. But they'd heard almost nothing about Jeff Titus being aggressive, of threatening violence against others. Michelle's statement to the cold case team is one of the exceptions. She told the investigators that, quote, she recalled one incident where she had a verbal argument with her husband over the telephone, and that Titus overheard this, and after she hung up, he offered to go to her residence and kick her husband's ass.
Jacinda and I had wanted to talk to Michelle about what it had been like working with Titus at the VA, but her address had been hard to find. For some reason, whenever we tried to plug it into our phones, the results that came back had us driving in literal circles, cutting through cornfields and leaping over highways, with no apparent endpoint.
How is this to follow this direction?
As we drove down a road that we thought must be in the rough area where she lived, we came across a house where a man and a woman were standing out in the driveway. We pulled in to ask for directions, or if we got lucky, maybe it would turn out the woman was Michelle herself. As it turned out, we did get lucky. The woman in the driveway was Michelle, but we didn't get a chance to speak to her.
This way. No, that way. I think that way. Try that. Hi, we're looking for... Is this it?
What?
Is this the right address?
Drive what?
Is this the right place?
Why?
I'm looking for Michelle Smock.
Why?
We're down here working on investigating an old case. And
old case of what?
From Kalamazoo. And...
You got to give me more than that.
So we're trying to talk to all the witnesses from the case file, and she was listed in it.
By who?
By the police that did the case file back in 2000.
And what's this referring to?
To a murder case that we're investigating.
A murder case?
Yes.
So who are you? Let me see your IDs. You're investigators. You got to have IDs.
No,
we're... Correct?
No, so
who are you affiliated with? Who are you affiliated with?
Let's go. I'm not dealing with this.
Well, what the fuck? You come up to my house asking me questions.
Let's get out of here.
I'd had my window partially rolled down, and as we were talking, the man had walked up to the passenger side door where I was sitting. He'd bent over and leaned in where I had the window open, with his face just inches from mine. And while I had a mask on, he most definitely did not. At that point, I decided it was time to bail. I hit the button to roll up the power window, and we reversed out. As we drove away, I could see Michelle watching us.
Cute daughter.
She knows exactly what we're talking about, too.
During the brief conversation in the driveway, Michelle had tried to intervene to talk to us, but each time she tried to approach, her husband had held a hand out in her direction, and she'd drawn away again. But she could hear us, and just judging from her reactions, I'm pretty sure Jacinda was right. She'd known exactly what we were there to talk about. And I think it's worth considering that there's maybe another way to interpret Jeff Titus's comments to her from all those years ago. The one the cold case team had interpreted as a threat. When Titus had heard Michelle and her husband arguing on the phone, and then after she'd hung up, he told her, "You want me to go over there and kick his ass?" But that phrase is usually not meant to indicate any actual intent to do violence. It's more an expression of sympathy to whoever you're talking to. I could see myself saying that maybe in that situation, and no one would ever think I'd meant it literally. Unless, of course, I ever wound up being accused of murder, in which case, yeah, maybe after that people would remember it as something I'd said in earnest. It's something you see happening again and again in the case file. Comments that Jeff Titus made to coworkers who acknowledged that they never thought twice about it at the time. And then years later, when they found out that he was being investigated for murder, they'd seen these old comments in a new light. A new and incriminating light.
Sexual harassment allegations may have been what ultimately led to the investigation that got Jeff Titus fired from the VA, but his problems had begun much earlier. Jeff's friend Tony, who was the union steward and so was familiar with some of the other disciplinary proceedings that had been brought against Jeff, says that Jeff's bosses had been looking for a way to get him fired long before the sexual harassment complaints were made.
The truth, but they were out to get Jeff. Jeff?
They wanted him gone. That's very clear from the files.
Oh, yeah. Well... they were working an angle. Norris was trying to pin it on him. He was making all sorts of calls, you know, trying to get Jeff jacked up.
This isn't paranoia. There were people at the VA who were really out to get Jeff. There are literally emails back and forth between some of his supervisors where they discussed whether certain minor infractions, like a uniform violation, could be used as sufficient pretext to go ahead and terminate him. And when the cold case team interviewed one of Jeff Titus's former bosses, he told them straight up that, yeah, he'd done everything he could to get Titus fired when he'd been the chief, but he'd never succeeded. And Jeff's bosses had fair reason to dislike him as an employee. There are plenty of examples of Jeff saying and doing things at work that were both weird and reckless, things that caused headaches for his supervisors. Here's Susan reading from one of the disciplinary reports in Jeff's personnel file.
At the first opportunity after Jeff returned to duty, I confronted him with a trap that was found in the VA hospital, which he readily admitted was his, and which he demanded we return to him. He also stated he was surprised we didn't find more traps because, quote, there are a lot more out there.
God, Jeff.
I tried to reason with Jeff about the folly of setting animal traps around a hospital property, but his position was intractable. He was petulant, felt singled out, and said it was harassment.
God.
It's just poor, like, who was it? Chief, is Captain Hobbs is like, animal traps with Titus's name on it, set in the fucking VA hospital.
And we have
psychiatric
is,
patients.
Titus is like, yeah, so.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's a good place to trap. I'm like, it's mine, give it back to me. And the chief is like, Jeff, this is a bad idea. Like, we're a psychiatric hospital, we can't leave freaking animal tracks. I can see why they wanted to fire him. I cannot say they were wrong.
I can see why they might want to fire him, too.
Now, to be fair to Jeff, the traps had not been set in a location where it was likely that any patients would ever encounter them. But still, it was a bad idea. Jeff Titus got written up for more mundane workplace infractions as well. For instance, in September of 1990, Jeff Titus had been working the night shift when he'd fallen asleep in the job. He'd been stationed out by a roadway, and at 4:35 a.m. that morning, his supervisor had gone by in his car and seen him sleeping inside. As the warning notice in his personnel file noted, you cannot monitor anything while sleeping, and you sure cannot observe anything. And then, a couple years later, Jeff Titus received yet another written reprimand. This time, it was because he and another security officer had been on patrol at the VA when they came across the scene of a recent accident, where a truck had struck a deer that was attempting to cross the road. The driver that hit the deer had been, quote, attempting to comfort the wounded animal when Jeff Titus arrived in the scene. And after assessing how bad his injuries were, Titus had taken quick and decisive action.
These old people hit a deer, and Jeff was going to put it out of its misery, but he bludgeoned it in front of the old people.
Jeff Titus then managed to make the situation even worse. State police were called to the scene, and Titus asked them for a roadkill salvage permit, which allowed Titus to legally take the deer home for processing. Titus was once again disciplined over the deer incident, both for exercising poor judgment due to him killing the deer in front of the horrified driver, and also for the appearance of impropriety due to him accepting a benefit from the state police officers in the form of the roadkill permit and thus creating a perception of a conflict of interest.
It's fair to say that Jeff Titus was not always a model employee. But some of his supervisors seemed to have disliked him for reasons that had nothing to do with his workplace conduct. Beverly, whose cousin Paul was at one time the chief at the VA, remembers him telling her about how much he disliked Jeff. But he would also never explain to her what exactly his problem with Jeff had been.
That's why my cousin was warning me, you know, don't hang around him and things like that, because he was just... He said, I have a very funny feeling about him.
It's not something that was ever explicitly written down in Jeff's personnel file, but from talking to his old coworkers, it became clear that there was another reason that Jeff's boss wanted him to be fired, and it had nothing to do with work.
Bill Hobbs was the chief of police when I left, and he called me probably a year after the murders had happened and had mentioned that Jeff Titus was one of the original suspects, and Bill and I were pretty close. I was his number one sergeant. I said, well, we both agreed Jeff probably did it. That sounded like Jeff Titus. So that's how I found out through Bill Hobbs, because I was working at the Battle Creek Federal Center at the time.
Mm-hmm. And why did you think it sounded like Jeff Titus?
Just the way he was. You could tell by talking with him there was some sort of a dark side or a not normal side to Jeff.
If all you knew about Jeff Titus was what you'd read in the transcripts and the case file, you'd walk away thinking that Jeff was a nightmare coworker. And Jeff for sure had coworkers who didn't like him. But after actually talking to people who knew him from the VA and his other jobs, they described a much more nuanced picture of what Jeff had been like.
If you need some help with a patient,
yeah,
you know, we had a radio, so they come right away up and stuff. You know, some of them got a little nuts, so we had to put them in cuff and belt. And whenever he was on, he was right there on the spot. But he never really, if I think back, he really never abused the patient or nothing. He was, you know, pretty nice to him.
I talked to the various police officers that he worked with, and they had a lot of negative feelings about Jeff. But when it comes to Jeff doing his job and them needing help, Jeff was right there.
Despite the various disciplinary problems that he'd had, Jeff Titus was actually pretty good at his job. Most of the time, anyway.
In 1994, Jeff's boss at the time, Chief Callican, had been interviewed by the VA investigators. Callican noted that while Jeff caused a lot of polarizing feelings among his co-workers, he had friends as well as foes. For every employee that complained about him, there was another saying that they wanted him there. Although that investigation had been for sexual harassment, the VA investigator was aware that Jeff had been a suspect in the Fulton Game area murders, and some of his investigation seems to have been directed with that in mind. The investigator asked Chief Callican if he'd ever seen Jeff Titus angry, but Callican said he couldn't think of any instance where he had. He had seen Jeff in physical confrontations, yes, but he'd always handled himself well. The chief had never seen Jeff lose his cool or become abusive. In the 2.5 years that I've known him, Callican said, I've never seen him get overly excited about anything. But that's just his nature. The VA investigator had asked Callican a lot of questions along those lines.
Do you think he is capable of harming another person? And I know that's a professional judgment I'm asking you to make.
Perhaps in a fit of road rage he could, but that's so hard to say. I'm not a psychiatrist. I have to base it on my personal observations. I've never seen him in a physical confrontation where he's ever lost control. Usually he's very calm, and when he reacts very rapidly. He don't waste no time. If he's got to react physically, he don't wait around and become indecisive.
Could Jeff Titus be vindictive?
I've never known him to be vindictive. I've never known a case where he displayed vindictiveness. Once again, I can't say. He could or he couldn't, you know?
Could he be described as intimidating?
A lot of people I've talked to, especially females, once again, it's a love-hate relationship with Jeff. Either they think he's sweet and kind, or they think he's morbid and lunatical or intimidating. He's got those eyes that will look right through you. And if you ever had a conversation one-on-one with Jeff, you'd know what I'm talking about. I've heard, for example, Laura make the comment that his looks intimidate her. Once again, a person's looks, you have to look past that. If you're in a position like I am, as a chief of a service, I can't take a person's looks to mean that he or she is a good or bad employee. I can't base my judgment based upon his looks. But Jeff does have those piercing eyes.
Jeff Titus's eyes are something that get commented on a lot. They're one of the reasons, for instance, that nurses told the VA investigator that they were intimidated by him. And it is true that Jeff has a distinctive appearance.
Here's a picture of this would have been before 90 because the kids are so little.
God, that's so 80s.
Have you seen Jeff as a kid?
No.
Yeah.
Okay, he looks kind of crazy there.
I think he has those eyes that people either are like attracted to them or find them spooky.
Yeah.
He looks like, this is not very nice, but he looks like the serial killer named... He's got the same eyes.
As the cold case team explained to Jacinda and her crew during filming for Killer in Question, Jeff Titus's appearance is also part of why he ended up being arrested and charged with a murder.
We gave the case to our local FBI. They sent it to Quantico, to the behavioral science team. Now, these guys are the best in the world. In the world.
Quantico called me up, said, hey, we believe Mike Brown's onto something. This Titus guy is, we believe, is your suspect.
The one thing that stuck out in my mind from Quantico was that picture of him pointing out where the gun was found. And if you look at that picture, as the FBI did, under a magnifying glass, it is hugely incriminating. He looks sociopathic. He looks hard. He looks mean. He looks incriminating. They looked at this picture, they looked at his face, and they said, look at that. The man just looks guilty.
Jeff Titus is not always the most photogenic person in the world, but the particular photo that Stu Fenton's talking about here, the one the FBI looked at with a magnifying glass and then concluded Jeff Titus looks guilty in, well, that photo looks completely normal to me. It's a photo that one of the original investigators took on the day that Jeff Titus called to report finding the shotgun. They got out there to get the gun, and then after, they'd taken Jeff Titus back to the game area to show him the crime scene. In the picture, Jeff Titus is gesturing towards the forest floor, but he's actually pointing towards where the bodies have been found, not where he found the gun. His expression is mostly neutral, perhaps a touch wary, which I think a lot of people might feel if a police officer suddenly started taking their photo. But Prosecutor Steve Fenton and Cold Case Detective Mike Workema, and apparently also the FBI, see something more in this image.
He's a creepy character.
A sociopath.
Yes.
Which is why he was able to pass a polygraph. Kill without conscience, as he told people he could do.
Did you talk to people about finding the gun and about the murders? I'm not what they testified to, but just in a general sense. Did you talk to people like, hey, I found a gun?
And people asked me questions about it and stuff. They'd heard about it at work, and they asked me about it, and I told them I found it.
So you did talk about it?
Yes, I did talk about it.
Jeff Titus doesn't deny that he talked about the murders at work. Though, not all of his coworkers recall him saying much about it.
A lot of the employees testified that he would be talking about the murders a lot at work.
He didn't talk to me at all about that. I think he might have mentioned, I think, like I told the other detectives, I think he might have mentioned that people are saying that, you know, I shot somebody out there on my property. I said, really?
He just said, I didn't, though, or he was not.
I really don't remember, dear, I'm being honest. Yeah. I think he said, well, I wouldn't, or I didn't do that.
He never tried to claim credit for it, though, to you.
No.
Beverly had been friends with Jeff, and they'd talked a lot at work, but she doesn't remember him saying much of anything about the case itself. Most of what she heard about it came from other coworkers and not from Jeff. On the other hand, some of Jeff's coworkers recall him talking about the case quite a lot. Paul Norris, who'd been Jeff's supervisor, told the Cold Case team that he had had a lot of conversations with Jeff about it over the years, though he couldn't recall Jeff saying anything incriminating about it. If he had, Paul would have had reason to remember it. He strongly disliked Titus and had been trying for years, without success, to find a way to fire him. But everything Paul remembered Jeff saying about the case was consistent with Jeff has always told investigators. About how, 2 days after the murders, he'd found the missing shotgun in the game area and then called in to report it. Some of Jeff's coworkers, though, recall him telling them a very different story. And each of them remembers something different. It's as if Jeff had told 10 different coworkers 10 different stories. But it took a little while for the Cold Case team to discover these stories. When they first began talking to witnesses out at the VA, none of the first dozen or so coworkers that they spoke to had recalled anything about Jeff saying he'd taken the gun home or cleaned it or anything like that. Then, after a few weeks out there, the Cold Case detectives talked to a nurse named Sandy. Their report from that interview notes that she gave them some important new information.
At that point, Sandy said something that no other witnesses who have been contacted have said. She stated that Jeff Titus told her that when he found the gun, he took it back to his residence and cleaned it. She stated that she never asked him why he cleaned it, but it did occur to her that since he was a police officer, that he should know better than to do that with something that might be evidence.
After speaking to Sandy, the Cold Case detectives immediately contacted Jeff's coworker, Mark, and asked to re-interview him. Although Mark hadn't remembered anything about Titus cleaning the gun when the Cold Case team had interviewed him the first time, in this second interview, he remembered all about it. As noted in the Cold Case detective's report,
Both Sandy and Mark, without any prompting from me, brought up the idea that the shotgun had been taken back to his residence and cleaned by him before it was ever turned over to the police. None of that information up to this point has ever appeared in the police report, either from the original report or from what the cold case team has developed up to now.
In the next few days, the cold case detectives found three more witnesses who remembered the same story about Titus cleaning the gun. And all of these three witnesses testified at Jeff's trial. The jury found what they had to say to be compelling evidence of Jeff Titus's guilt.
He's supposed to have a criminal justice background, and he cleans his gun instead of taking it. And he cleans everything. He cleans the ammunition that was in it. He cleans the gun inside and out.
Jeff Titus told police that he'd never touched the shotgun. So why then did he tell co-workers that he took it home and cleaned it? Jeff says the answer to this is simple. He didn't tell them that.
Well, people didn't like me. You either liked me or you didn't
like
me.
Yeah, but that doesn't
mean... There was really no in-between.
But just because I didn't like you doesn't mean you couldn't have said you brought the gun home.
No, I didn't bring the gun home. And I didn't say that I brought the gun home.
One of the witnesses who testified that Titus had said he took the gun home and cleaned it was Chief Callican. That's the same chief that testified in the 1994 sexual harassment investigation. And in 2002, at Jeff's murder trial, Callican said that after becoming chief, he'd heard rumors from some of the other officers about Jeff Titus's possible role in the Fulton Game area murders. So he sought out Titus and told him to take a walk with him. And then he began grilling him about the homicides that his co-workers suspected him of committing.
Did you ask him any questions about what he had done with the gun?
Yes, sir. I asked him exactly that, what he had done with it. He explained to me that he had kept it a couple days and then turned it into the sheriff's department. And I asked him at that time, why would you keep the shotgun for a couple days knowing of its evidentiary value? And he said that it was rusted when he found it, and he wanted to clean it up before he turned it over to them. Him being a former Marine and desiring to take care of the weapon properly, he had wiped it off and oiled it. And he had also kept it to play games with the sheriff's department. He felt that they had insulted him during the course of the investigation that they had conducted, and it was his way of getting back at them.
But this memory that Chief Callican had of Jeff telling him that he cleaned and oiled the gun, that memory was new. He didn't have it before. When he'd first spoken to the cold case team, Callican had told them that he thought he'd once asked Titus, quote, "Did you wipe the shotgun off?" But Callican had told them that he did not remember how Titus had responded to that question, and he had not remembered Titus's response until he testified at the trial.
The second witness who testified about Titus taking the shotgun home was Michelle, the witness who Susan and Jacinda had tried to talk to in her driveway but hadn't been able to. At Jeff Titus's trial, Michelle had testified that Jeff Titus once told her he'd found two dead hunters in his property. He also told her he'd found a gun with the bodies, and he'd decided to keep it for himself. He said he grabbed the gun before heading back to his house to call the police to report finding the bodies. And as for how the two hunters ended up dead in Titus's property, Michelle said, quote, "Titus had just said that they deserved it for being on his property because they were trespassing." Now, to the prosecution, the first part of Michelle's testimony was damning for Titus, because it couldn't possibly be true. Titus hadn't found the bodies. So if Titus was claiming to have found them, it could only be because he'd killed them himself. And as for the second part of Michelle's story, the part about Titus saying the hunters deserved it, that was also damning, because it was an indirect expression of culpability. The dead hunters had deserved to be killed, Michelle says that Titus had told her. But this testimony from Michelle in 2002 was vastly different from what she'd said before in 1994, when she'd first been interviewed under oath as part of the VA's investigation into Jeff Titus. Because back in 1994, Michelle hadn't remembered Titus ever saying anything about Titus taking a gun home with him. Instead, she'd told the VA investigator,
"It was like a few years ago or something. He said that the FBI was investigating him because they found some dead guy on his property or something, and that the gun that killed him was his or something, and that he got let off, that they found that he wasn't guilty," or something like that.
Michelle's memory was already vague in 1994, just a year or two after she said this conversation with Titus had occurred. She referred to it as, quote,
"that time when he talked about, you know, somebody dying or whatever."
In this interview from 1994, Michelle had been trying to give evidence of how intimidating Jeff Titus had been, but she didn't have that many examples. Her complaints had included things like how one night she'd gone into work and she'd gotten a flat tire out behind the hospital, and Jeff and another coworker had come out to change a tire for her. Michelle told the VA investigator that she thinks she would have been scared if it had just been Jeff Titus out there, but since the other coworker was there as well, it'd been fine. So if Jeff Titus had told Michelle that he'd found two dead hunters on his property and that those hunters had deserved to be killed, there is every reason to think that she would have shared that story with them at the time. It's a much clearer example, anyway, of potentially intimidating behavior.
There was also another nurse who also testified about how Jeff Titus had told her that he'd taken the shotgun home with him and cleaned it. But this nurse had not been involved in any of the sexual harassment complaints. It was Irene, the nurse who hadn't minded when Jeff Titus would stop by her ward to chit-chat.
I said, I don't have no problem with him. He's not bothering me, you know. I'm glad he's here, the patients, you know. Mm-hmm. But I didn't hear any problems. Like when I was on my shift, I didn't have no problems with the patients or him.
At Jeff Titus's trial, Irene testified that just a week or two after the murders at the Fulton Game area, Titus had come up to her ward to talk, like usual. But this time, she said, he told her about how he'd found the shotgun on the border of his property and how he'd taken the gun home with him. To that, Irene had responded, "You don't just find a nice gun and think you can keep it." But Titus had brushed off Irene's concerns and told her that actually, he thought he could just keep the gun, and that's why he had cleaned it. Last year, though, when Susan and I went to speak to Irene, she told us a very different story.
But he told me about he shot a hunter. It was on his property, you know.
He shot a hunter?
Well, they were hunting.
Uh-huh.
And what happened? He was on his property, and he told him to go, and I guess the guy didn't go fast enough, and he shot him.
He told you that?
Yeah.
Today, Irene remembers a conversation with Titus in which he confessed to the murders.
He said he shot at somebody because he wouldn't get off his property fast enough.
When he told you that he shot a hunter, do you think he was joking or was he like...
I thought he was, but then deep in my heart, I thought, no, that's him.
But she does not recall the conversation that she testified about at Jeff's trial, when she remembered that Jeff told her he'd found the shotgun and kept it.
Do you remember anything about Titus talking about a gun?
Oh yeah, he said he had a bunch of guns.
Did he ever talk about like any gun in particular?
If he did, I don't remember.
There is nothing to suggest that Irene is lying about her conversation with Jeff Titus. She has no animosity towards him. She certainly has no motive to lie about it now. But if she's telling the truth about what she remembers, then the memory that she has is false. That's not how she's ever remembered it before, not in any of the recorded statements from her that we have.
If Jeff Titus ever did tell anyone that story about what he did with the shotgun, if he ever really did tell his coworkers about how he'd taken the gun home and cleaned it and oiled it, then Jeff Titus was lying to them. Because Jeff Titus did not take the shotgun home and clean it. He couldn't have. The shotgun had not been cleaned. In the original police report, where the evidence was logged in and described, the entry for the Mossberg shotgun reads, quote, "Chamber was dirty, and the barrel has lead marks or residue in it, showing that the weapon has not been cleaned and is dirty." And in the notes in the Michigan State Police Lab, which later examined the Mossberg, the shotgun was described as having been both dirty, inside, and out. True, there were no fingerprints found on the gun, so it can be said the gun was clean of fingerprints, but the gun itself was not clean. There's another reason, too, to be skeptical of this story about Titus telling his coworkers he cleaned the shotgun. Because some of Titus's coworkers told the cold case team that they'd remember Titus's statements in a very different way. For instance, Paul Norris, who was one of the chiefs that had strongly disliked Titus and had wanted him fired, had told investigators that he too had heard Titus talk about the murder investigation. And Paul Norris remembered Titus telling people about how the shotgun had been cleaned of any fingerprints. But Paul Norris told the cold case team, quote, "Titus was saying this is information that he had learned, not that Titus himself had done the cleaning of the shotgun." Paul Norris wasn't alone. Other coworkers remember Titus's comments the same way, but none of them, of course, had been called to testify at his trial. There was also another nurse, a woman named Donna. Donna said that very shortly after the murders had happened, maybe 2 weeks or so later, she'd taken a patient outside for a smoke break when Titus came up to her and began talking about the murders. So Donna had asked him a question.
And I said to him, "You did this." And he said, "Probably."
Donna told investigators that she'd never had a conversation with Jeff Titus before this. She thought he was weird, so she'd kept away from him. So this conversation had happened out of the blue. After Donna asked him twice if he'd done the murders, and he answered twice by saying, "Probably," Donna said she went back inside the hospital and told a coworker about what had happened. And after that encounter with Titus, Donna told the court, she'd refused to ever go out in a smoke break again. She'd been too afraid of Titus. She also never talked to him again. And other than the one coworker, she never told anyone else about the incident either. Not until 10 years later anyway, when the cold case team interviewed her. That's when she finally told investigators that Titus had confessed to her that he'd probably done the murders. Donna told the cold case team she felt very badly she hadn't been brave enough to come forward to tell the police about the confession sooner. She knew it had been important information, but she'd been very frightened if she'd said anything about it, Jeff Titus would find her family and kill them.
According to cold case team prosecutor Stu Fenton, Donna's testimony all by itself was proof beyond a reasonable doubt of Jeff Titus's guilt. "It's 98% of a confession," Fenton said, "close enough to show Jeff's guilt." But Jeff says this conversation never happened.
The other thing Workema said to ask you is, why did you tell people? I think there was a woman at your office who asked you, did you do it? And your response was, "Probably."
I didn't say that. I know everybody thought I did. I mean, that was a thing going around.
Donna's name never surfaced in any of the VA investigations into Jeff. She'd never been identified as someone Jeff Titus may have acted inappropriately towards. So we have no prior interviews from her to compare with her statements to the cold case team. But Donna did tell investigators that she'd confided in exactly one coworker about Jeff Titus's semi-confession, though. The cold case team never spoke to that person, but Susan did. Donna had been a close friend of hers at work, she said, but she'd never heard Donna mention anything about Jeff Titus confessing to murder. She remembered talking to Donna about how they didn't like Jeff because he was a braggart, but that was it. And there are lots of other things, too, from Donna's statements and her interviews with the police that don't quite fit together. Like how Donna told detectives that Titus had hit on her at work. And when they asked her how he did so, she told them that Jeff Titus was always asking her where, quote, her and the other girls went out for drinks after work and if he could meet them there. But Jeff Titus didn't go to bars. He didn't meet up with coworkers at the bar for a drink after work or anything like that. Not a single other witness at the VA has ever mentioned anything like that happening. And there's another detail from Donna's story that doesn't quite add up either, because Donna testified that she was certain this conversation had happened very shortly after the murders, no more than 2 weeks or so. And actually, this is a common theme in a lot of the statements from Jeff Titus's co-workers. A lot of the witnesses say that they'd had these conversations with Jeff immediately after the murders occurred. Just a day or two later, some of them said. A week or two at most, no more than that. But these witnesses are wrong. Their conversations with Jeff Titus could not have happened as they describe. Because in September of 1990, 2 months before the murders, Jeff Titus had gotten caught sleeping on the job. The following month, as a result of the sleeping incident, Jeff had been fired. He lost his job. As far as anyone knew, he wasn't coming back to the VA at all. But Jeff Titus had appealed the decision, and after a review, the VA had decided to reverse the decision and reinstate his employment. His termination had been converted into an 86-day suspension. Jeff Titus was not working at the VA when the Fulton Game Area murders occurred, and he didn't return to work until 2 months later, on January 20th, 1991. Which means all of the employees who testified about having conversations with Titus at the VA immediately after the murders were remembering things wrong. All of these workplace conversations with Titus had to have happened at least 2 months after the murders, if not longer, because Titus had been suspended from work at the time.
Trying to investigate these statements from Jeff Titus's coworkers has been frustrating because there's just so little there to hold on to that seems solid. Most of what his coworkers recall is vague and inconsistent, and none of it's ever corroborated by any other evidence. But it's also not surprising given the context. These witnesses were testifying about a casual conversation they'd had with a coworker that they hadn't seen in nearly a decade. Just because their memories were jumbled up by the time they testified at Titus's trial doesn't mean they weren't remembering some kind of conversation they'd once had with him. And cold case detective Mike Workema is likely right about what led to Titus's arrest.
Jeff Titus put himself in prison with his mouth.
The reason why the cold case team was able to find 15 coworkers who could testify that Jeff Titus had made strange comments to them at work is almost certainly because Jeff Titus had in fact made strange comments at work. Jeff's friend Tony, the union steward, had seen how during the sexual harassment investigation, Jeff Titus had talked himself into getting fired from his job by rambling on about his shooting abilities during the VA hearing. And Tony had also seen how, when it came to the Fulton Game Area murders, Jeff had been talking himself into trouble there, too.
We had conversations. People that knew Jeff, you know, it was a concern to us, especially how he would talk. You know, you tell him, shut your mouth. These people don't know you. You're going to bring yourself a lot of problems by talking the way you're talking.
What kind of things would he be saying?
Well, like we're playing cards at lunch in my shop, and Jeff would sit in. We played euchre. He would sit in, and new guys would come into the shop and stuff, and he'd say, yeah. He'd introduce himself, you know, Jeff Titus, and you know who I am, you know? And he'd say, yeah, I'm the guy that shot those guys down by Athens. Shut your mouth. These people don't know you, and they don't know you're talking crap, you know. But he would just say random weird things like that. But we knew better.
Tony had told an investigator this same story when he was interviewed before Jeff's trial. His memory, at least, has not changed in the past 20 years. Though no one at the euchre table seems to have taken Jeff Titus's comments seriously, since no witnesses testified at the trial that they'd heard him make comments around the shop like that. Tony himself wasn't called as a witness either.
I was always mad why they didn't call me for a character witness, but maybe I present the wrong picture of Jeff.
Tony says that he and Jeff's other friends had known Jeff was just goofing around when he'd said things like that. They'd known he was just talking crap. But they'd also known that Jeff's weird comments were trouble. And they'd seen that trouble coming a decade before it arrived.
He shouldn't be in prison. He shouldn't have been convicted. And, you know, it's caused me anxiety about it because I know as the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, that's not Jeff.
That's all for Episode 9 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Jeff Titus. We're back on Monday with Episode 10, and don't forget to send us your questions for this week's addendum episode. Amit Lotelhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production was done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast. Music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for episodes are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. They're brought to you by our amazing transcript team, Dom Logis, Britta Bliss, Skylar Park, and Erica Fladell. And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online and on all social media. Our handle is at UndisclosedPod. We're at Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.